There is this this statistic that floats around engineering management circles that always kind of depresses me.
Let me guess. The 30% rule.
Yeah, exactly. The idea that the average senior software engineer, someone you are paying very well to solve complex logic problems, spends less than 30% of their time actually coding.
Honestly, I've seen estimates even lower than that. It really depends on how you define, what coding actually is in today's landscape.
Right. And the rest of that time is, well, it's what we call overhead.
The maintenance tax.
Yes. It's hunting for API keys, pasting error logs into Jira tickets, summarizing like three different Slack threads just to figure out why the Tuesday bolt failed.
And for a long time, the industry answer to that was just hire more people, just throw headcount at the problem.
Yeah.
But if you add more people to a deeply complex system, you just create more communication overhead.
You scale the noise.
Exactly. You don't
Yeah.
solve the problem, you just make the meetings longer.
Which perfectly sets up what we are doing today. Welcome to the deep dive. We are jumping into a fascinating article from Avahi. It was published this month, February 2026, and it's titled Agent-Based AI Systems Explained for Modern Engineering Teams.
It's a really comprehensive piece.
It is, and our mission today is to get past the hype, because I want to be super clear right up front. This is not about using a generative AI chatbot to write a polite email to your product manager.
No, definitely not. We are talking about fundamental architectural change here.
We're talking about the shift from chatbots to actual agent systems, and the source argues that this shift is the mechanism that finally attacks that 70% of overhead we've been drowning in.
It's a shift in agency. I mean,
Yeah.
that is the key word. We are moving from tools that answer you to tools that act for you.
Okay, so let's get right into the definitions then, because the word agent is just, it's getting entirely abused right now. Everyone calls their basic Python script an agent. How does this Avahi article draw the line? What makes a true agent different from just a really well-crafted prompt in an LLM?
The source draws a really hard line between a talker and a doer. Think about a standard interaction with a chatbot. You ask a question, the model computes a probability distribution, and it spits text back at you. It's totally passive. It literally sits there waiting for you to prompt it again.
Like a consultant, it gives you advice, but it doesn't do the work.
Right. An agent is fundamentally different because it has an objective and a feedback loop. If you tell an agent, triage this incident, it doesn't just give you a numbered list of the steps you should probably take.
It actually
It
doesn't.
goes out, it reads the logs. Maybe it realizes the logs are ambiguous, so it decides on its own to check the database metrics instead. It correlates that spike with the last deployment, and then it reports back with a synthesized result you can act on.
So it has an internal loop. It basically talks to itself.
Exactly. It reasons about its own progress. It plans, it acts, it observes the result of that action, and then it acts again based on what it learned. That plan, act, observe loop is the defining characteristic of an agent.
The article uses a really specific example regarding incident response that I thought clarified this perfectly.
The triage workflow.
Yes, walk us through that.
Sure. So if you use a chatbot for an incident, you might paste in a huge error log, and the bot says, oh, this looks like a database timeout, which is helpful. But you, as the human, still have to go log into the database, check the connections, and fix it.
You are still the one doing the context switching.
Right. But an agent, in this context, is already hooked into your observability platform. It sees the PagerDuty alert, it queries the specific Kubernetes pod that failed, checks the CPU usage history, and then actually creates a summary ticket with the root cause analysis already attached.
And this ties directly into the economic context the source brings up. They cite that massive McKinsey estimate, the one saying generative AI could create up to $4.4 trillion in annual value.
Mostly through productivity gains and knowledge work.
Exactly. But the Avahi article makes a really sharp point here. For engineering teams, that value doesn't come from typing syntax faster, it comes from removing the context switching.
It's all about cognitive load. If the AI agent handles all the investigative grunt work, the human engineer only has to step in when a high-level judgment call or decision is needed.
Okay, so I buy the promise. The vision is great, but I want to understand the actual mechanics underneath this. And I appreciate that the source didn't just wave their hands and say, oh, it's magic machine learning. They break down what they call the anatomy of an agent into five core building blocks. Let's unpack what is actually inside an agent.
Yeah, let's strip it down to the studs.
First up is the brain. This feels like the most obvious one.
It is. This is the LLM core, your GPT-4, Claude 3.5, whatever model you're running. Its job is purely reasoning and orchestration. It interprets the instructions and decides what to do next. But, and the source is emphatic about this, a brain in a jar is completely useless.
Because it can't touch anything.
Right. It has no way to interact with your infrastructure.
Which leads us to component number two, the hands. And honestly, reading this, this felt like the real game changer to me.
Oh, the hands are where all the complexity lives. This refers to tooling and function calling. It's the API layer. For an agent to actually check a build status in your CI pipeline, you have to explicitly give it a tool, a programmatic function, that knows how to call that specific API.
They need database access, read and write privileges.
And code execution environments, too.
And boxes.
Crucially, yes. If you want an agent to write and then test a Python script, it needs a safe environment where it can run that code without accidentally dropping your production database. The hands are how the agent reaches out and alters the real world.
Okay, so brain and hands. Component three is memory. And we aren't just talking about the context window here.
No, because context windows are volatile.
Yeah.
The second that chat session ends, all that memory is wiped. The source draws a distinction between short-term memory, which is just remembering the current conversation, and long-term memory.
And long-term memory is where they bring up vector stores. Let's unjargon that for the listener for a second. What is the agent actually doing with a vector store?
The easiest way to think of a vector store is like a semantic filing cabinet. The agent can store project metadata, runbooks, past incident reports in there. When a new problem pops up, it doesn't search this database by exact keyword matches. It searches by meaning.
Like, has anyone seen an error that feels like this one before?
Exactly. It retrieves that historical context to help solve the current problem. That's what we mean by RAG retrieval augmented generation.
Got it. Brain, hands, memory. The fourth block is the conscience, which sounds a bit poetic, but they mean something incredibly rigid here. They mean governance.
They mean policy as code.
Yeah.
Look, if you give an AI system hands, you have to put heavy gloves on them. You simply cannot let an automated system have root access to everything. The conscience is a set of hard constraints.
Security rules.
Yes, but strictly enforced ones. Like, you are allowed to read data from production, but you can only write changes to staging. Or you cannot execute any process that takes longer than 5 minutes or costs more than $5 in compute.
You have to treat these policies like hardcore application security, not just polite suggestions in a prompt.
Precisely, because prompts can be jailbroken. Hard-coded API constraints cannot.
And finally, the fifth component is the eyes.
Observability hooks. This gets overlooked so often. If an agent fails a task, you can't just shrug and say, oh, well, AI is weird. You need logs. You need to see the exact sequence of steps it took.
The trace of its thought process.
Right. Step one, I queried the database. Step two, I saw a memory spike. Step three, I decided to restart the service. You need those traces to debug the agent itself. You also need metrics on success rates and how often humans have to override the agent's decisions.
Okay, so that gives us a single, fully functional agent. Brain, hands, memory, conscience, eyes. But then, about halfway through the article, the source makes this major pivot. It essentially says, don't stop there because one agent is not enough.
Yeah, they tackle the God agent problem.
Why is that a problem? Why can't I just have one massive, incredibly smart model that just does everything for my team?
It comes down to context, window, bloat, and focus. Think about it. If you give one LLM a massive prompt that says, okay, plan this new feature, write the back-end code, write the unit tests, check for security vulnerabilities, and then update the public documentation.
That's a lot for one brain.
It's too much. The instructions start to bleed together, the model gets confused, and that is when it starts hallucinating. It forgets the strict security constraint you mentioned in paragraph one, because by paragraph 10, it's completely hyper-focused on fixing a CSS bug.
So the architectural solution is multi-agent systems. You build a squad.
You mimic the structure of a real human engineering team. You divide the responsibilities.
The article lists four specific roles for these agent squads, and I really want to break these down. I think this is the actual blueprint for how engineering teams will implement this tech. First up is the planner agent.
The planner is essentially your tech lead. It doesn't write a single line of code. Its only job is to take a vague, messy request from a human and break it down into a logical step-by-step plan. It scopes the work and creates the subtasks.
Then it hands those tasks off to the retriever agent.
The researcher, yeah. So the planner says, hey, we need to use the internal payment API for this feature. The retriever's job is to go dig through the company wikis, the Confluence pages, the old Jira tickets, find the exact documentation for that API, and package it up for the next agent.
Which is the coder agent.
The specialist. The coder receives the step-by-step plan from the planner and the specific documentation from the retriever, and its only job is to write the syntax. It doesn't worry about the big-picture architecture. It just worries about making the code compile and do what the plan says.
And finally, the reviewer agent.
The QA or security engineer. And this is where the multi-agent approach is so powerful, because you can give the reviewer agent a completely different system, prompt, and personality than the coder.
Oh, that's interesting.
You tell the coder agent to be creative and efficient, but you tell the reviewer agent to be strict, paranoid, and highly skeptical. The reviewer critiques the coder's work before a human ever even sees a pull request.
So you're setting up an adversarial dynamic.
Exactly. You are building structural checks and balances into the AI system itself. The coder writes it, the reviewer tries to break it.
That makes total sense. But taking a step back, I want to talk about how this actually gets built into a company's workflow. Because I imagine a lot of people listening to this are thinking, oh my God, do I have to rip out my entire AWS infrastructure to support a squad of autonomous AI agents?
Thankfully, no. The source is very reassuring on this point. The correct mental model is that agents act as a layer sitting on top of your existing stack. They are just another client consuming your existing internal APIs.
So where do the human engineers actually interact with them? Do we all have to log into some new clunky web portal?
If you force developers to use a separate portal, adoption will be zero. They just won't use it. The article strongly advocates for meeting engineers where they already live. These are called ingress points. So the terminal, your IDE like VS Code, or directly inside Slack.
I really love the terminal idea. Just imagining typing something like agent troubleshoot dash dash service equals payments directly into my CLI and having the squad spin up in the background.
It's incredibly frictionless. And behind that simple command, there is an orchestrator layer. This is the brainstem of the operation. It uses frameworks like LangGraph or AutoGen or CrewAI to route your CLI command to the right squad of agents.
Now, there is a very specific piece of architectural advice in the Building Production Ready Workflows section that I want to highlight. They compare using a planner agent versus using a static graph. This felt like a critical fork in the road for anyone building these systems.
It really is the most important design decision you'll make. A planner agent, like we discussed, is dynamic. You give it an open-ended goal like investigate this memory leak, and it figures out the steps on the fly. The path is totally unknown. It might take 3 steps to find the issue. It might take 30.
Which is fantastic for flexibility and discovery, but it sounds terrifying if you need strict control.
Exactly. So for processes that require rigid compliance, say onboarding a new employee and provisioning their access, or running a required security audit, you absolutely do not want a creative planner agent winging it. You want a static graph.
Fixed steps.
Step A, then step B, then step C. And if step B fails, the whole process halts and escalates to a human. No improvising.
So the rule of thumb is dynamic planners for exploration and troubleshooting and static graphs for compliance and security workflows.
That's the safest way to architect it.
Speaking of safety, let's move to tooling safety and data scoping. We touched on the conscience earlier, but the article gets really into the weeds here. And honestly, the data scoping part scared me a little bit.
It should scare you. It's a huge risk surface.
The risk of memory leaks. And they don't mean RAM memory leaks. They mean information leaking across boundaries.
Right. If you have an agent system that supports multiple different teams or tenants, you have to be incredibly careful with its long-term memory. You do not want Team B asking the agent a debugging question, and the agent gives them an answer based on Team A's highly confidential, unreleased architecture documents.
Just because they happen to share the same underlying vector store.
Exactly. If you aren't partitioning the memory correctly, the agent will just pull whatever semantic match fits best, regardless of who owns the data. It's multi-tenancy for AI. Just like you wouldn't let customer X query customer Y's database table, you cannot let them share the same embedding space without strict isolation.
And the final safety net the source mentions, which I think is the ultimate break glass pattern, is keeping a human in the loop.
This is non-negotiable for high-risk actions. The agent can do 99% of the prep work. It can write the patch, run the unit tests, draft the deployment script, and verify the staging configuration. But the final act, actually pushing that code to production, must require a human to explicitly confirm it.
So the agent serves up the volleyball and the human spikes it.
That's a great way to put it. It perfectly balances velocity with accountability. You get all the speed of AI preparation, but you retain the judgment of a human for any irreversible action.
So zooming out for a second, we are really looking at a future where managing an engineering team might literally mean managing a mixed squad of humans and software agents.
It's going to require a completely new skill set. People are starting to call it agent ops. We're going to need engineers who are skilled at designing these multi-agent interactions, defining the API boundaries, and monitoring the operational health of these digital teammates.
It's just a fascinating evolution of the industry. We went from coding in binary to assembly to high-level compiled languages, and now we are moving to intent-based engineering.
We're just moving one more rung up the abstraction ladder. We are automating the management of the code creation, not just writing the code itself.
So here's the challenge for you, the listener. The Avahi source suggests that you shouldn't start by just downloading LangGraph and playing around with frameworks. You need to start by mapping your user journey.
Right, don't go looking for a nail just because you just bought a fancy new hammer.
Look at your typical week. Look at your engineering team's week. Where is the burnout happening? Where is that repetitive drudgery that requires a lot of context but almost zero creativity?
Is it triaging support tickets? Is it writing database migration scripts, updating internal documentation every time a microservice changes?
Find that one. Painful workflow. Map out the manual steps your team takes today. That map is the functional spec for your first multi-agent squad.
And remember the tooling safety rule. Start them with read-only tools. Let the agent look at your systems, let it draft reports, but do not let it touch or change anything until you fully trust its reasoning loop.
That is great advice to close on. We've linked the original Avahi article in the show notes. It's a dense read, but it is absolutely worth it if you are planning to build in this space. And remember, if you could clone your absolute best senior engineer but strip away all their burnout and context switching fatigue, what is the very first repetitive task you would hand off to them? Something to think about. Thanks for jumping into this deep dive with us.
Catch you next time.